heard in 2017, including this fall's annual appeal. We are very, very grateful for your generosity. But if you have not yet had a chance to make a contribution, there is still time. So, you know, as you all know, donations are very critical to everything we do here, maintaining our building, building our collections, adding new new exhibitions and children's programs. So it is it's very, very important, and we are very, very grateful for every contribution. All contributions are tax deductible, and you can make them online, by mail, or in person. We're happy to have them. On behalf of the board and the staff, I want to thank you all. I'm going to assume that most of you here are fans of children's literature, and we were just talking earlier about this, and personally, I return again and again to Gillette Burgess's The Goops and How to Be Them, because as a really good kid and an obliger personality trait, according to Gretchen, yes, I always found The Goops so, you know, pleasingly naughty. So. But our two presenters tonight are very big fans of Kids Lit, and I know we're going to have a fantastic conversation about children's literature, human nature, and also their wonderful new books. Davi is selling them. Davi from the Corner Bookstore is selling them outside, so please grab those later. I'm sure our presenters will be happy to sign them. So a little bit about Bruce and Gretchen. Bruce Handy is currently a contributing editor of Vanity Fair, where he has written on topics and personalities as diverse as Mad Men, Amy Schumer, film composer John Barry, Pee Wee Herman, Miley Cyrus, the J.T. LeRoy hoax, Cinerama, and the history of flight attendants. He's a former writer and editor at Spy and Time, and his articles, essays, reviews, and humor pieces have appeared in the New York Times, New York Magazine, Rolling Stone, Vogue, Village Voice, and The New Yorker, among others. Bruce was nominated for an Emmy in 1993 as a member of Saturday Night Live writing staff, and he won a GLAAD Award in 1998 for his Yep, I'm Gay Time cover profile of Ellen DeGeneres. Mm-hmm. The Wall Street Journal calls his debut book, Wild Things, The Joy of Reading Children's Literature as an Adult, a delightful excursion, engaging and full of genuine feeling. And Vanity Fair calls it pure pleasure. I concur. I bet you loved it, too. So.
Thank you.
Gretchen Rubin has been interviewed by Oprah, clerked for Sandra Day O'Connor, and walked arm-in-arm with the Dalai Lama. She's the author of several books, including the blockbuster New York Times bestsellers Better Than Before, The Happiness Project, Happier at Home. Her latest book is The Four Tendencies, the indispensable personality profiles that reveal how to make your life better and other people's lives better, too. In addition to her books, she has a wide active following on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, YouTube, popular weekly podcast, and is much in demand as a speaker. Fast Company named her to its list of most creative people in business, Inc. lists her as one of the top 50 leadership and management experts, and according to Business Insider, she's one of the 22 brilliant thinkers everyone should follow on Twitter. So while you're out there following Gretchen on Twitter, please just go find the library and follow us on Twitter too. Oh, and we're very also excited to announce that she just joined the board of the New York Society Library. We're very happy. So please join me in welcoming Gretchen and Bruce.
Thanks so much for those lovely introductions. I sort of want to hijack the evening, and I didn't know you clerked for Sandra Day O'Connor. I want to hear all about that. And the inner workings of the Supreme Court and all that, but I guess that'll be another evening. I just also wanted to reiterate, I love this library so much. I wrote like big chunks of my book here. I use the collection all the time. So I just want to reiterate, yeah, give money. I hope everybody here's a member. If you're not, join. It's an amazing institution, and I really, yeah, I do love it here. So my book is about children. The other thing too, obviously, probably most of you know, but there's an amazing children's library here that both myself and my family have had many hours in. And also, yeah, if you love children's books, especially if you love picture books, they always have new great ones, and it's definitely worth your while to go up there and spend some time there. It's also fun too, because like school gets out, there's, you know, tons of kids here with their parents and caregivers and reading and having fun. It's just, it's a great atmosphere. So I was going to talk, I'm going to do a short reading. I was just going to talk a little bit about my book, which really kind of came out of the experience of having kids and like, you know, like a lot of parents reading to my kids every night. I guess what was interesting to me was that I hadn't really thought much about children's books since I had been a kid. You know, I took one kid lit class in high school where I kind of discovered to my shock that The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was actually very Christian themed. A book which had sort of escaped my notice in second grade, which is actually C.S. Lewis's intention, as I later found out. But anyways, you know, like a lot of parents with newborns, my wife and I, people gave us kids' books, and you know, a couple of them. One we got, like a lot of parents, we got I think 3 or 4 copies of Goodnight Moon, which was actually a new book to me because probably I guess it looks like a lot of people here are roughly my age. And that wasn't really, you know, Goodnight Moon didn't really become this sort of ubiquitous Goodnight Moon that it is now until I think really the late 70s or maybe the 80s. I should know this. I think it's actually in my book, but it was one of the first board books in whatever, you know, late 70s, early 80s period it came out. And that's sort of when it really took off and became, you know, as I said, ubiquitous. But anyway, so, you know, it was kind of new to me, but, you know, I remember reading it, you know, repeatedly to my kids. And kind of, you know, something just got, you know, the more I looked at it, the more I learned that you know, it was this sort of happy, sing-songy, you know, gets them to bed, you know, it had that nice sort of functional quality of getting the kids to sleep. But I don't know, the more I looked at it, I started to realize that the author, Margaret Wise Brown, was, you know, really kind of saying something, I think, you know, profound about the way kids, very young kids, experience the world. And I think it's there in the, you know, the opening lines, you know, in the Great Green Room, which, you know, when I thought about it when I was a little kid, a little kid's bedroom to a 1 or 1.5 year old or whatever, it's huge, right? It is. It's this vast, huge space. It's like, it's like Monument Valley or something. And the idea of, you know, the objects in the room, you know, like the ball, ball of yarn and the kitten and the mittens and all this stuff, you know, this idea of sort of looking at things and naming them, and, you know, to a kid that stuff is actually very, you know, is very profound. You know, we just think of it as a sort of sweet little thing, but I think the more I read it, and I read it a lot, you know, it revealed, you know, just a really, I thought, a profound understanding of a young child's mind on the part of Margaret Wise Brown. And then we also have somebody else who's given us, you know, The Runaway Bunny, which is also charming in its way. I'm going to talk about that in this piece I read. But it was, you know, it's also by Margaret Wise Brown. And someone's like, oh, well, this is, you know, I started in the way that probably most of us as readers or, you know, fans of film or dance or whatever, you know, it's like, oh, here's an interesting author. I like these two books. I want to find out more about her. And got a bunch more of her books. And, you know, she wrote, I think, 60-something titles during her lifetime. And there's been, you know, a bazillion more published posthumously because she left behind all kinds of scraps. And, you know, I mean, they're not all great, but most of them are pretty good. You know, just really realizing, wow, this is, you know, this is, you know, she was fascinating. So I got, you know, and then I guess, really, the book came about for me just kind of thinking about children's literature kind of critically in the way that I guess, as somebody who writes about culture, I tend to think of everything. And also just finding that I was enjoying it. You know, that I was actually getting as much pleasure out of reading to my kids just from reading the stuff as I think they were. They would, even if they were here and they have said that in interviews, that a lot of times they thought I was getting more out of it than they were. I didn't realize it this at the time, but a lot of times they were kind of indulging me in some books and just, you know, pretending to like them. The one book this book really came out of my experience with Where the Wild Things Are, which is a book I didn't really like as a kid, and then, you know, I just thought it was weird, didn't get it, whatever. I knew it was sort of important, but because, you know, I had a new barrier. That's the other thing. I know somebody's written a book about children's literature. I should know what the Caldecott and the New Barrier, and I always get them confused. But anyway, it had a sticker on it. So, but anyways, then again, you know, when our daughter was born, along with Goodnight Moon and Runaway Bunny, we were given Where the Wild Things Are. And just reading that as an adult, I suddenly, it worked for me in a way that it hadn't as a kid. You know, it was just, you know, honestly, also, you know, at that point I blogged, I don't know, 15 years of therapy, which I think helped too, because it's a very psychologically astute and Enrich book, and I suddenly saw it as that. I thought, oh, this is a fantastic kind of, you know, post-Freudian fairy tale about a kid dealing with his anger and so on. And of course, when my kids were old enough for me to read it to them, they didn't like it either. So that was really the seed for this. So I'm going to read a little bit from the second chapter. The book is sort of organized, starting with basically with Goodnight Moon and other kind of books for very young kids, like The Very Hungry Caterpillar and The Snowy Day, and it kind of goes on to books of sort of increasing complexity and books that are sort of looking out into the wider world, and it ends with a chapter on books for children about death, which is mostly an excuse to talk about Charlotte's Web. And yeah, my party trick is, which yeah, I think Jen has seen this before, if somebody asks me about Charlotte's Web, I'll probably actually start crying in front of you. It's sort of a Pavlovian response at this point. Yeah, Charlotte died alone. That's anyway, so this is chapter two. It's about books about families and parents, and it's called Runaways. Portnoy's Complaint isn't a children's book, notoriously not, but it is indisputably a child's book. The novel's very first word is she being the mother of Philip Roth's hero and narrator, Alexander Portnoy. He's on his psychiatrist's couch as the narrative begins, dredging up memories of her. This is Roth. She was so deeply embedded in my consciousness that for the first year of school, I seemed to have believed that each of my teachers was my mother in disguise. As soon as the last bell had sounded, I would rush off her home, wondering as I ran if I could possibly make it to our apartment before she had succeeded in transforming herself. Invariably, she was already in the kitchen by the time I arrived and setting out my milk and cookies. Instead of causing me to give up my delusions, however, the feat merely intensified my respect for her powers. Sophie Portnoy is not only powerful, like many omnipotent beings, she is also easily bruised and vengeful. So she makes a habit of banishing young Alex from the family apartment for transgressions so minor that her nature is not apparent to the perpetrator himself. She cannot love him anymore, Sophie says, not a little boy who behaves like you do. Roth doesn't let Alex's figuratively impotent, literally constipated father off the hook, but it is Sophie who dominates both novel and son's psyche, to the point that the book reads like an extended primal scream of a Jewish mother joke. And yet anyone of any ethnicity, religion, or gender should be able to recognize the yin-yang, push-me-pull-you, let-me-go tension between parent and child that Roth vivisects with such anger and glee. Because just as nearly every culture seems to enjoy some version of a fillable pancake, whether crepe, roti, tortilla, or wonton wrapper, so most of us know Sophie Portnoy's. Some may be more neglectful than smothering, others more passive-aggressive than aggressive-aggressive, but all, whatever their gender, leaving tire tracks back and forth across their offspring. As the British poet Philip Larkin famously put it, they fuck you up your mom and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. I bring up Portnoy's Complaint because it reads like an R-rated antithesis of the work I really want to talk about, The Runaway Bunny, which, in its own sunny way, is as incisive a treatise on the parent-child bond as Roth's novel. I also bring up Portnoy's Complaint to highlight the fact that books for very young children occupy a rare literary preserve where mom and dad don't fuck you up. It is among picture books for the very young where you have to look far and wide for withholding mothers and fathers with anger issues. There are a few characters I might accuse of sloppy parenting, such as the man in the yellow hat, who is so laissez-faire he never realizes that merely admonishing Curious George to be a good monkey and then abandoning him for hours on end will never not prove a recipe for disaster. The mother in the Cat in the Hat is so loopy she leaves her children in the care of a fish. Hers will be the house where all the kids go to smoke weed in high school. But most, they should write a sequel, actually. Most parents in books for the very young are steady, kind, and dull, as child services cases are more like presidents in textbooks from the pre-pathography era. Why are the literary scales on the rest of the shelves weighted so heavily toward bad parenting? Tolstoy's line about all happy families being alike is the wrongest literary maxim this side of Fitzgerald's claim that American lives lack second acts. But no one would deny that unhappy families make for better stories. Also, what we need from stories changes as we age. When we are very young, what we need are our parents. When we are older, what we need is to pull away from their gravitational field, or at least to try and maybe kick up a little ruckus. The Runaway Bunny endures in part because it hits a sweet spot between Emmett's abject dependency and a toddler's itch to make some actual use of his or her newfound mobility. Anyone who read The Catcher in the Rye or The Outsiders as an adolescent will remember how this book crystallized the conflicting emotions, the yearning for security, and the need to rebel so endemic to that stage of life. Well, The Runaway Bunny serves a similar purpose for the pull-up years. And, you know, I think we're going to stop.
I'm going to stand up because it's just when I'm talking for more than 5 minutes, it's easier for me to stand. But I want to say how much I love New York Society Library. It is my playground and my cubicle. I live a block away. I come here constantly. I'm so happy to be talking in the beautiful members' room. So I wish we could use laptops in here, but I understand. So I'm going to talk about, we'll start a movement. So I'm going to talk about the four tendencies, and then Bruce and I are going to have a little conversation amongst ourselves, and then we're going to open it up to questions, which is always the most fun part. But I'm just going to give you a quick overview of what my four tendencies framework is. And I got the idea for the genesis of the idea happened over at Atlantic Grill, you know, on Third Avenue. I was having lunch with a friend. And she said something that absolutely electrified me, even though I've heard many people say similar things before. She said, because I am kind of a happiness bully, that's what my sister calls me, so I was grilling her about her happiness and her habits, and she said, I know I would be happier if I exercise. And the weird thing is, in high school I was on the track team and I never missed track practice, so why can't I go running now? And I thought, well, why? It's the same person, it's the same behavior. At one time it was effortless, now she can't do it. How do you explain that? What's going on? So there were a million patterns that I tried to pull together, the hardest intellectual work of my life, and then finally I realized, by looking down at my messy to-do list, that the core was at the core of all of this was this idea of expectations. So we all face two kinds of expectations, outer expectations and inner expectations. Outer expectations are things like a work deadline. Inner expectations are things like your own desire to keep a New Year's resolution. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to explain the four tendencies, then I'm going to have everybody raise their hand and say what tendency they are, because it'll be really fun to see who's here. And then I'm going to give you like a quick tip for each tendency, and then we'll have our conversation. So, upholders, questioners, obligers, and rebels. And this has to do with how you respond to expectations. So, upholders readily need outer and inner expectations. They meet the work deadline, they keep the New Year's resolution without much fuss. They want to know what other people expect from them, but their expectations for themselves are just as important. Next, questioners. Questioners question all expectations. They'll do it if they think it makes sense. So they make everything an inner expectation. If it satisfies their standards, they'll do it no problem. If it fails their standard, they will resist. They typically hate anything arbitrary, inefficient, irrational. Next, obligers. Obligers readily need outer, but they struggle to meet inner. And this explains my friend on the track team. When she had a team and a coach waiting for her, no problem. When she was trying to go running on her own, she struggled. Then finally, rebels. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. They want to do what they want to do in their own way, in their own time. They can do anything they want to do. They can do anything they choose to do. But if you ask or tell them to do something, they are very likely to resist. Typically, they don't even want to tell themselves what to do. So now I'm going to go through and ask you to raise your hand. And by the way, if you're thinking to yourself, I question the validity of this framework, you're probably questioning. Okay, so first, upholders. Upholders readily meet outer and inner. Okay, that's my hands up. I'm an upholder. Okay, good. Next, questioners. Questioners question all expectations. They'll do it if they think it's okay. I need identified. All right.
Then, I actually took the quiz. So
okay.
I'm official.
Oh, you're officially a questioner. Okay, that's good. Next, obligers. Obligers readily meet outer. They struggle. Oh, there's an enthusiastic camera. Okay. And then finally, rebels. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. Okay, there's one. They usually sit in the front or the back. I don't know. But you know, this thing was like, you have to come at 6:30 on a Thursday night. So rebels are like, yeah, I want to show up at 6:30. Can we do that? But good, you're here to represent. So this is what we would typically see actually in the world. In the world, the biggest tendency is obligers. For both men and women, it's the biggest tendency. You either are an obliger or you have many obligers in your life. Next, after that, questioners. And that's definitely what we focus on here. That's also a very big category. The smallest tendency, it's a very conspicuous tendency, but it's a small tendency, is rebel. That's the one the fewest people belong to. And my tendency, the upholder tendency, is only slightly larger, which explains many mysteries in the world to me when I figured that out. Most people are not like me. And I remember saying to my husband, like, do you know, I just figured out that I'm part of this like extreme fringe personality type. And he was like, you think? He was not surprised. So now I'm going to give you like a quick tip. And it's all much more complicated, but I'm just going to like give you like the drive-by tidbit, something to take home. So upholders, a lot of advantages to being an upholder. But all with all the tendencies, the upsides are also the downsides. So what are some of the negatives or limitations that can help you deal with yourself better if you're an upholder or deal with an upholder in your life? One is they can be rigid and flexible because they have an idea of how things are going to execute. They have a schedule in their head, and it can be very hard to move them off of that. They often don't do well in situations where there's a lot of value in things in being spontaneous or fluid or flexible. And they can sometimes experience tightening. This is when the rules get tighter. I have a friend who is an upholder who had, you know, a Fitbit, and he said, you know, I was going to get my 10,000 steps in, and my wife was asleep in bed, and I was like jogging next to the toilet at midnight because I was going to get my 10,000 steps in. Sometimes this can be good, but it can also become choking. So that's something. And upholders can often seem cold. Because it's like, you know, I know we have guests this weekend, but you know I'm training for the marathon, so I'm going to do a 15-mile run. So that's just like what's going to happen. So that can seem cold. It seems appropriate to upholders, can seem cold to others. Next, questioners. There's a lot of great strengths with questioners. They're the people who keep us all on track, because they're saying, why are we using this software? Why are we doing this by Friday? Why are we doing this at all? Why are we listening to you? They keep us all from wasting our time or energy or money. But they can drain and overwhelm others with their constant questioning. They themselves can suffer from analysis paralysis because their desire for perfect information means that they can't make decisions or move forward. They need to use things like deadlines or limits or using trusted authority in order to like help them make a decision. I have two friends who are married who are questioners, and it took them 18 months to get a new dishwasher for their house on Long Island because it was like every time they tried to get a dishwasher, like, what about this one? No, what about this one? If we're doing the dishwasher, let's do the countertops. If we're doing the countertops, we should do the roof deck. Mm-hmm. And they just couldn't decide. So they had to finally set a deadline. And the other thing about questioners is they can be perceived by others in a negative light. And so if you are a questioner child who's questioning a teacher, or you're a questioner employee who's questioning a boss, you may think that your question is completely legitimate. Why do I have to learn the multiplication tables if I can just look it up in my phone? You know, why are we switching to this software program if just the fact that corporate says so is not a legitimate answer. But if you have a thin-skinned boss, if you have a teacher who doesn't want anyone to question authority, that can get the questioner in trouble because they can seem stubborn or disrespectful or undermining or questioning someone else's judgment. So questioners need to learn how to ask questions in a way that seem constructive and don't make other people feel defensive. Next, obligers. So obligers, they are the rock of the world. They are, you know, they're great to have around. And really the frustration of obligers falls on obligers themselves, because they're frustrated by the fact that they can meet commitments to everybody else, but they can't meet commitments to themselves. So here is the most important idea from the book. If there's one thing that I think the most people have like underlined and learned from, is this. If you are an obliger, or you're dealing with an obliger, who's struggling because you're not able to meet an inner expectation, which by definition you are, that is the definition of an obliger, the solution is outer accountability. If you want to read more, join a book group. That is what is needed. Do not think about taking time for yourself. Do not think about your motivation or your priorities. Give yourself better accountability. So what would I say now to my friend on the track team? You need to give yourself better accountability now, just like you had outer accountability then. You could join a class. You could work out with a trainer. You could run with your dog, who's going to be so disappointed if he doesn't get his daily run, plus he's going to tear up the living room. You could think of your duty to be a role model to someone else. There's a million ways to have better accountability once you realize that that is what is needed. A striking pattern within obligers is obliger rebellion. This is when obligers meet expectations, then suddenly they snap and they think, this I will not do. And it can be small, like, I'm not gonna answer your emails. Or it can be big, like, I'm gonna get a divorce, I'm gonna end a 20-year friendship, I'm gonna quit and go work for a competitor because I've had it you're dead to me, this is over. And this can be beneficial because it like explodes an obliger out of a situation where they feel exploited or neglected, taken advantage of, unheard, or where expectations are too high. It can also be very disruptive. And so, because it's not a reason to push back, it's just like a volcano exploding. So it would be good for all of us to watch out for that place of deep anger and resentment that obligers fall into so that they don't fall all the way into obliger rebellion. And then finally, rebels. So a lot of power in the rebel tendency. They can do anything they want to do. They're very in touch with their authentic self. They're not afraid to flout convention, but it can be challenging to live or work with somebody who doesn't want to do anything that you ask or tell them to do. So what do? You can appeal to their identity, which is the kind of person they want to be. So for instance, let's say you had a child who wasn't practicing the piano. You would not say, you have to practice the piano. Your teacher says you have to practice the piano. Let's set up a reward and punishment system. It's not going to work with the rebel. But what you could say is, wow, I saw that your teacher gave you a really challenging piece of music. I don't know if most 10-year-olds could play something like that, but you are such a performer. I hope that I get the chance to see you up on stage performing that music because I have seen what you can do. You are a true performer. Yes, I am a performer. And what does a performer do? A performer must practice. That is the identity of a performer. Or you can give information, consequences, choice. This is when you give them the information they need, you tell them the consequences, and then you let them decide. So you could say, well, you know we have this 10 a.m. Wednesday mandatory staff meeting that you don't come to. But do you know what we do at this meeting? We look at all the projects that are coming up for the next couple months, and all the people at the meeting take all the interesting projects for themselves. And then we leave the boring projects for everybody who doesn't come to the meetings. So you know the meeting is at Wednesday at 10 o'clock. This is information consequences. But you can't rescue the rebel for the consequences, and you can't nudge or remind, because the more we nudge or remind a rebel, the more we ignite the spirit of resistance. So that is the very, very quick overview of the four tendencies, and the last thing I would say is it's really meant to be something that's not a label that would confine you or make you feel cramped or like an excuse, but it's just meant to be a spotlight that can illuminate hidden patterns of our nature. Because when we understand ourselves and we understand other people, then we can be happier, healthier, and more productive. So thank you. And now we'll talk
more. Well, I was going to say, as a questioner myself, and there's the Christian has a quiz you can take in the book, and it's also on
online,
which is cool. And then it's always fun to put things online, and it spits out what the answer is. But I felt as a questioner, I like that you call it the four tendencies, and it's not like the four exact types. You know, that you leave some wiggle room that suits me well. It was funny. I wanted to start talking about it because I was thinking it would be fun to try to figure out, who are some great characters.
Yeah.
I thought it'd be great to figure out, characters from children's literature to fit into these. But, when I was thinking about it, it seemed like I realized children's literature seems to be filled with lots of questioners and rebels. Ramona or... Ramona's probably a questioner, I'm thinking. Olivia the Pig is probably a rebel. Curious George is kind of a rebel. I was having a hard time thinking of...
Well, one of the most famous characters in all of children's literature is the upholder. Who knows it? Who's the most famous children's literature upholder? You know this.
Hermione.
Oh. Yeah, Hermione. Classic.
Wilder's
a questioner.
Yeah. Mary is maybe an upholder. But then I was thinking,
We don't know enough about Mary's inner life.
I cracked it. And tell me if I've got this. If my understanding of the tendencies is right. But I thought the March sisters. Okay, Joe is a questioner, right? Obviously.
Yes.
And Meg, I think, is an upholder, probably. Beth seems to be like a total obliger. Although I thought it was interesting when you're talking about obliger rebel. I mean, I'm not personally a big fan of Beth March, but I'd like to see if she had lived longer. I bet she might have had the obliger rebellion you were talking about, which would have been interesting. And then Amy, I don't know if Amy's a questioner or a rebel, but she seemed like She could be. Anyways, that was my best stab at finding, you know, four people who fit those roles. I did pretty good. Is that okay? Yeah.
Well, the thing is, we know a lot about how Joe sees the world, but we don't really know any, because the thing about the tendencies is you can't judge by what people do. You have to understand the way they think, or you have to see them acting in a way. So a lot of the other sisters, I could see them fitting into a lot of different categories, whereas Jo is very clearly a questioner, because she's like, why can't I do this? Why do I have to do that? She has inner direction once she wants to.
Why can't I go romping?
Yes, I'm wrong. It's interesting, I was trying to find characters, and so I was thinking, well, I think Jane Eyre might be a questioner. And literally on the first page, I'm saying paragraph 3, her hateful aunt says, Jane, I hate questioners. She's literally called a questioner.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's easy.
Yeah.
But so I have a question for you.
Okay.
I have to say, of your book, I think most books have a right length, and I think most books are probably a little bit longer than they need to be. And your book is one of the few books where I wish that it came in 10 volumes, mm-hmm. and I would have read every volume with such enthusiasm, because I loved every book that you talked about. I went back and reread or read for the first time many books that you talked about, and there were so many books that I wanted to call you up and say, now you have to write a chapter about Edward Eager, or you have to write a chapter about Elizabeth Enright. But I noticed that you didn't write much about people who have been writing, say, in the last 10 or 15 years, so I wondered, like, why you didn't write about, like, Philip Pullman, you wrote a lot about C.S. Lewis, or, you know, just, like, a lot of the ones who are writing now.
Well, yeah, so Philip Pullman was actually an interesting one for me because I was originally, the chapter on C.S. Lewis, which is, you know, about religion and children's literature, it was originally going to be kind of a duo thing about Philip Pullman and C.S. Lewis, and honestly, I want
the cutting room floor version of that.
Well, the problem for me was, like, I read the Philip Pullman books, and I thought the Golden Compass was pretty great, but then the other ones got totally nutty. I just completely lost the thread of those books, to be honest. I just didn't really honestly know what to make of them. And I didn't really have, it was interesting because my own personal beliefs probably comport more towards Philip Pullman's than to C.S. Lewis's, but I think I talked about Philip Pullman in a footnote. I didn't have anything to say about him, really.
I didn't last 10 or 15 years, just like as a group.
Well, that's the thing. I think, I think it's probably a fault of the book. I was hoping to make sure, I wanted stuff to be, like, relatively universal. I mean, I wanted stuff that I was pretty sure most people would either have read or kind of know about, you know, just because it's kind of in the culture. And probably, to be honest, you know, there's obviously the bias of me being a 59-year-old white guy, you know, who grew up in America. You know what I mean? I was trying to be kind of Catholic about it, but, you know, it's definitely, you know, my frame of reference is my frame of reference. And yeah, I made a point of trying to nod at a lot of at some more contemporary books. And I have there's sort of an appendix at the back where I talk about, you know, I have an appendix about book pairings, like books that might be fun to read together, and I try to work some more contemporary stuff into there. But yeah, I think it's a good question. I think it is in some ways.
I think reading a book as an adult is different if you also read it as a child than if you're reading it for the first time as an adult. So I thought maybe you were just more interested in when, like, you were revisiting something like Charlotte's Web. You've read many times, and that's different from reading like Eleanor and Park, where reading it the first time.
There's an aspect of the, I don't know if it was really, it wasn't really apparent in what I read, but there's an aspect of, kind of ignoring everybody over here. There's an aspect of sort of memoir, and not like, you know, like a little bit like I was talking about my response to Where the Wild Things Are. There's sort of an element of that kind of threading throughout the book too, so yeah, presupposes that I have read stuff. Although, that, you know, I did a chapter on there's a chapter on, you know, quote unquote, girl books that most boys, at least in my generation, didn't read. You know, basically Little Women and Little House books, and, you know, Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret. So those were all new discoveries. I'm curious because I know you, I mean, you may not know this, but I probably might have, I hope not telling tales out of school, but Gretchen actually is involved in a number of book groups of adults reading.
Three
children's
literature books, yeah.
But yeah, so I'm curious what you said. Yeah, you said some of the books that I wrote about you hadn't read. I'm curious what which ones were new, which the things that I wrote about were new to you.
Oh gosh, I'm trying to remember. I mean, most of them I had read, but like, I think there was a book that you mentioned about the writing of E.B. White. You got me going like deep into E.B. White. I read the letters. There was been a book that was written all about writing of Charlotte's Web. I have to look at your table of contents, because definitely I've read most, because, you know, yeah. But then, like, it was such a pleasure, like, The Wizard of Oz. It's, there's so many books where I love them so much and I know them so well, but then it's fun to read about the backstory or the history of it. Or, like, Margaret Wise Brown. She was a nut. I mean, she had a crazy life.
Yeah.
And, so it's just interesting. You wouldn't necessarily pick that up from the books. Maybe you would, but, I felt like you... Reading them enriched my appreciation for books that I knew well.
That was probably the hope.
Do you think it seems to me that there is a new respect for children's literature among adults? It's just like a kind of fiction that people enjoy. Just like some people like mysteries and some people don't. Like I don't really like mysteries, and some people like science fiction. I love science fiction, but some people don't like science fiction. I think some adults are like, yeah, some adults like children's literature, just like a thing. And it seems like now that's a belief that's much more widespread and much more respectable than it was maybe 10 or 15 years ago. When I started my children's literature book groups, I didn't know if there was any other adult in New York City who wanted to read children's literature. Now it seems like a lot of people will talk about that.
I think that's true. I think, yeah, especially at YA, amazing college age, but you just didn't know what percentage of YA books are actually bought and read by adults. I bet it's
at least 25%.
A significant chunk, yeah. I think that's true. And I think I have a sort of a person, you know, like not crusade, but I think especially I wish picture books got more sort of respect in the sense that I think you know comics and graphic novels and comic strips have gotten a lot of sort of attention, both just sort of academic and generally, and are respected as the great. Great art forms that they are, and I think picture books need a little more of that. I think, to me, picture books are in some ways, I think, especially as pure visual works, the great ones I think are often even more, even more visually sophisticated than a lot of graphic novels and comics, which actually take a lot of their cues from cinema. I think, whereas I think a great picture book is in some ways a much more unique unto itself work.
I would love to read a book that you would write about picture books. I love picture books.
Yeah. Well, that was the other thing, too, I know, because I had to keep, my friend and colleague Jen encouraged me, I think, to add some stuff about some of the illustrators, which I should have done in the first place.
Like Garth Williams. I mean, you just can't even stand how good Garth Williams is.
You guys all know Garth. I mean, he illustrated the Little House books, he illustrated Stuart Little and Charlotte's Web. He did the first Francis book, and then they kind of...
Then they worked... Yes, you wrote about that,
yeah.
About how they ripped him off. Yes.
Then Russell Hovind's wife took over, but basically based on Garth Williams' designs. Just a ton of other amazing books. I was very happy to see they just reissued the Beverly Cleary... Henry Huggins and the early Ramona books, they just reissued with the original illustrations by Lewis Darling, which are also, I think, really amazing. You know, they put out, like, maybe starting in the 80s, they put out new editions with kind of more contemporary illustrations, which I thought were really pretty cruddy.
I was in Canada when there was a new edition of Anne of Green Gables that came out, and it was like this busty blonde-haired girl in a plaid shirt, and the scandal that she would not have red hair. I was very glad to see that as a red-haired person, because they just flagrantly ignored the red-hairedness of Anne, which is so key so sometimes terrible things happen with these reissues.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's, if 80s-looking Ramona or Busty Anne Green Gables get more people to read these books, maybe there's some good in that. But yeah, I think they're not that much good. Should we get you open to questions again?
Yeah.
You get a gold star if you ask the first question.
Thank you.
I wonder if both of you might be able to talk a little bit about the uncertain times we live in. So I'm sort of thinking, do people gravitate more? I mean, self-awareness is what we need, and especially in higher sectors right now. But would people gravitate more toward understanding their personality in a certain way? And also in children's literature, I wonder if people might want to kind of shelter in the real truths of children's literature that are also couched in this kind of secure going back to where you were comfortable and taken care of. And so I just wonder if you can riff a little on uncertainty and whether even that fit into any of your thinking.
Well, for me, it was funny because, I mean, it didn't really, because I think I signed a contract for this book in 2010. I wasn't anticipating the Trump presidency, but I was not. I sort of think that's what you mean when you're talking about uncertain times. No, it was funny for me, though. I mean, I don't know. Sorry to reveal my politics, but yeah, no, after the election, I was just thinking, you know, I knew my book was coming out this summer. I just thought, oh my God, you know, is this country going to even exist? You know, I can't believe I finally finished this book that I signed a contract for in 2010, and now it's, you know, it's going to be published in a post-apocalyptic wasteland, you know, used for that, you know, cooking or something. But no, it was interesting. But then I think it was in January or something when they came up with the cover, which I love, and I'm so grateful to Simon Schuster for it. And I just posted it on Facebook, and I said, oh, you know, here's my cover design, which kind of, for me at least, it was my kind of like, you know, coming out party for the book. But all these people were suddenly like posting, oh my God, that's sort of what you're saying. Oh my God, this is so what I want right now. You know, I'm so freaking out about everything that's going on in the world, and just to read about kids' books just seems like that would be, you know, a great balm or something. So I was like, oh, hey, silver lining, you know, great. That'll be good for me. So, and, you know, so we're still here, and the book came out, so.
Yeah. No, I think it's definitely when there's a sense of uncertainty in the world, I think it does make people feel like, well, can I do a better job of just, like, controlling what's within my control? And so it makes them want to turn inward and think about, well, is there something I can do to make myself happier or calmer? Like, a lot of habits that people are talking about right now, to me, are habits related to getting enough sleep, managing news, not allowing yourself to get overwhelmed, sort of managing the emotions related to it. And so I think, yeah, that people really are looking for ways to try to understand how they can, because often we know what would make us happier, but then it's like, well, why don't I do it? Like, I know I'd be happier if I, like, got off Politico and went to bed at 11 instead of staying up until 2 a.m. watching, you know, John Oliver, whatever. Why don't I do it? And then, so I think people are looking for trying to understand how they can, like, stay calm and within their own head.
But you never know if I go up Politico, like, 2 minutes later, they might post the big smoking gun story or something. And I'd still get
it'll
still there.
Be
I'd
it. It'll be there at 6:30
yeah.
in the morning.
Yeah,
when you roll over and lovingly pull your iPhone to your chest, you know, before you even kiss your spouse. Yeah.
Do you know some problem? Like, I have, yeah, yeah, like probably like all of a sudden my iPhone is like the bed, and it's like, you know, I get these little, you know, pushes, you know, push announcements from the New York Times. So it'll be like, kind of half awake at like 6:30, and suddenly it's like the things are coming off. I'm just like, oh my God, no.
You can turn off your notifications.
Yeah, and then it's, yeah. Should you get this? Is getting full
of like. Yeah, I got a million of them. But don't you find that people want to, audience questions, yes.
This
gentleman. Yeah, what recent children's books would you recommend we read?
How recent?
The last 2 years.
I'm like so bad with names, I'm gonna forget the author illustrator, but I love a book called They All Saw a Cat, which mm-hmm. came out last year as a picture book. Oh yeah, it's amazing. It's basically it reminds me it's I don't think it's at all derivative, but to me it has the the kind of flavor of Eric Carle, where it's just it's kind of just worked out in a really interesting way. But it's about, yeah, just how a cat is seen from different perspectives, whether, you know, a child or a canary or a goldfish or a dog or whatever. And then each illustration sort of reflects that. And it's really wonderful. There's another book, another picture book I really love called, sort of similar, again, very different, but it's called Over and Under the Pond. And it's kind of, it's just a mother and a boy out in a rowboat on a pond. I think this came out this spring. It's sort of a series. I think there's like Over and Under the Snowbank. I think there's some other one. It's one in the series, but it's just beautiful. It's sort of like here's the bug, and then here's the, you know, the trout or something that they're about to come and get it. And just like really spectacular illustrations. But again, just this great, you know, very kind of simple idea that worked out really, really beautifully.
So I'd say some of my favorites are La Belle Sauvage, which is the new Philip Pullman, which I was eagerly waiting for. A book that I have not been able to get out of my head is Strange the Dreamer, which I really like, which is fantasy. The Hate You Give is a book that everyone's talking about right now, a great book. An adult novelist whose works that I very much admire, Scarlett Thomas, just started a children's YA trilogy, called the Dreamquake Trilogy. So the first one, I think, is called Dragon's Green. Just read that. Really highly recommend that. I just discovered somebody named Nina Kariki Hoffman, who nobody has ever told me about. I'm like, how is it that I did not know about Nina Kariki Hoffman? So if you like fantasy, I recommend Nina Kariki Hoffman.
That's a great name.
I know. She lives in Portland, Oregon. I know.
You have a question?
I have a question. I think I only have, you know, 20-year-old grandchildren now, so I don't really know about little children so well anymore. But aren't children a lot different nowadays than when drawing that we have? So is literature changing to reflect that?
One thing I would say that's interesting. Is children's literature changing to reflect how children are different today? One thing that's interesting is how, I wonder what you have, like, if you read something like Rebecca Stead, what's the name of her, When You
Goodbye.
Find Me? I always forget that title. Like, a lot of people who are adults now don't know how to handle how children and young adults use technology. So they will set books in the past to avoid having to deal with the problem of how do children actually use technology. So that's sort of a narrative problem on the writerly side, which is children are experiencing this, but then how do you account for it? Not that many writers have really done it in a very sophisticated way, I don't think. So that's a challenge. That's how children are different.
Going back to what you mentioned earlier about Mr. Trump, and we all feel a lot more anxious these days, I think children must be experiencing that too.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's definitely related to the whole, there's this whole, especially for teens and younger kids, you know, there's all these dystopian books like the Hunger Games. And so my kids were reading those, and I was kind of appalled. It sounds, you know, so horrible. I don't know if everybody knows this. You know, this set in the future, and there's these games where kids have to, basically kids, you know, are gladiators, and they have to kill each other. And it's actually like, you know,
and it's all televised. It's highly televised. That's the point of it.
Yeah, it's so brutal. And I was thinking, I was pretty laissez-faire about what I love my kids reading, but then I started thinking, like, I read some pretty dark, horrible stuff when I was a kid. You know, I was reading
The Giver,
Time, 1984. I mean, I didn't know, I wasn't into the V.C. Andrews books when I was a kid. I knew a lot of kids were, you know, that was like, you know, under the, I'm not an adolescent psychologist, but yeah, there's something about this dark, depressing stuff that stirs kids. It stirred me, you know. Stirs my children.
I have a 7-year-old daughter, so I can speak a little to your point. I'm finding it very interesting rereading books that I loved as a child, the Little House series, the Ramona books, with my daughter. A lot of them are really quite dark, and we remember them as being very comforting. But the Little House series, their life was brutal. The Ramona series, her parents, they have the father loses a job, and
proportionately more female obligers than male obligers, or do you feel like rebel adults are would tip more towards questioners as you get older?
I very much believe in the genetic basis of personality, so I believe that these are things that you bring into the world with you, so you're not one at 20 and one at 40, you're not one at work and one at home. It's not a function of like your upbringing, though of course your environment would shape it. You know, like if you're a questioner in North Korea, you're gonna learn to like hold that back, whereas if you're a questioner in Silicon Valley, that could be great. So I think your environment would shape how much you express it. For obliger is the largest tendency for both men and women. I think sometimes people talk about it in different ways. So like you might, like I have a friend who's an obliger and his whole thing is, I do everything for my clients. I don't have time to exercise. I don't have time to eat right. Cause I do everything for my client. Cause I'm a badass. You know what I mean? I'm like, well, you're an obliger. You know, you're meeting all these outer expectations. But to me, I'm like, well, what about your expectations for yourself? So he really heroicizes it. So I think sometimes depending on circumstances, again, you might paint it in a different light, but it's still the tendency is fundamentally there.
This sounds like guys here making them heroicizing, you know, like some might see as a major trait.
Andre Agassi, if you've read the amazing memoir Open, mm-hmm. He is this textbook. Like the hair was standing up on the back of my neck as I was reading that book. You so perfectly fit my framework.
You know, yeah. When you're like just is it hard to stop thinking about this, like when you're just like meeting people? Yeah, like when we were talking upstairs, you go, okay, yeah, questions or anything or whatever, you know, does that?
Yeah, no, because I'm always trying to
turn it off or?
No, I'm always trying to be like, how fast can I get it? Yeah, because there are certain words that are tip-offs. Mm-hmm. That if somebody gets to a word, I'm like, okay, I think I got the diagnosis. But it's fun.
I was just going to add to the last question, which is birth order, because there's a great book called Born to Rebel, and there's a chapter on which of Henry VIII's wives cut their heads and lost theirs. And it's more apt to be the younger born or the elder born, and I'll let you figure out.
Well, it seems like the research suggests that birth order really doesn't have any influence on adult personality. It feels like it does, but it seems like most of the research suggests that it very much affects your relationship within your family, but in terms of your general adult personality. Many people have said to me, well, of course I'm an X because I'm the middle child, or I'm the oldest child, or I'm the youngest child, but it works you can fill in any blank, and it kind of makes sense. So I think it's not really part of birth order.
I think I want to write a book now using the wives of Henry VIII as a temp. You know, like,
yeah, I know.
Are you an Anne Boleyn?
Well, that's true. That's a great idea. That would be so fun. Except are people's history good enough?
Yeah.
Where's Helvy?
I can only think of two, and I'm not even sure I got the second one.
This is similar to that I was thinking before about the tendencies with teenagers, because I have teenagers. I know from your podcast that you have teenagers, and I tried to get my two teenage boys to take the quiz, and they were kind of like just the context of it.
Right.
And fit for them. So I'm just wondering, because obviously they're in such a sort of fertile developmental stage, and like, have you thought about it in terms of teenagers and does it apply to them, or is it something that because they're still, developing, it's not really, even though you say it's genetic, I'm just curious about teenagers and their portion.
Well, one of the things that's really come, like since the book has come out, so many people have asked me to create a quiz that's specifically for children. So that's something that I would like to do. Now, you're exactly right that, children aren't autonomous in the way that adults are, so you can't always tell what their tendency is. Like, one of my children is a freshman in college, and I only recently really figured out what her tendency was. But often it's apparent very young. Like, my first child was an upholder. I mean, my second daughter was clearly an upholder very, very young. And many rebels have told me that they have a vivid, vivid memory, like from being 2 or 3 years old, where they realize no one can make me do what I, And sometimes people will say to me, well, all toddlers are questioners, or all teenagers are rebels. They really aren't. Like, if you run across the real thing, you know the difference. And again, you don't always know what someone's tendency is from the way that they act, because it matters what they're thinking. So like a friend of mine said, well, anybody who knew me in high school would have said that I was a rebel. But of course, I was just doing what my friends expected me to do. Or if you had a teacher, like let's say there are two children who are refusing to do their homework, like, you know, because people often say to me, my kid's really smart, but he gets really bad grades. Why? And I'm like, well, it could be one of two things. It could be a questioner child who's saying, you're an idiot, and it's a big waste of my time to write this book report, so I'm not going to do it. And that's questioner, you're wasting my time. Or it could be a child who's saying, you're not the boss of me, you can't tell me what to do, and that's a rebel. And so if you knew why they were having a reaction, you would be able to communicate with them in a more effective way. So I don't think you can always tell easily, but sometimes you can. I think with many children, you can. I've talked to many people about like, oh, what do I do with my 5-year-old rebel, or what do I do with my 6-year-old upholder is frantic because X, Y, Z. So sometimes you can tell.
That would actually be a good thing to do, like a gap parenting sequel, or, you know, in a...
Well, there's a whole section in the book that's prepared. Yeah, but I
like that too, the idea that, yeah, the peer pressure is like, I started smoking because I'm an obliger.
Oh, no, that's very common. No, and it's actually, things like that are hard for obligers because it's like, well, everybody's having a drink at the office, you know, at this business dinner, I have to have a drink. And it's like, and as an upholder, I'm like, why would you feel like you have to have a drink? If you don't want to have a drink, don't have a drink. Or if you want to have a drink, have a drink. But don't do it, like, how would that even matter? And then life feels that outer expectation much more heavily.
Yeah?
I agree. Bad combination,
Well, so you're right that so when rebels pair up, they almost always pair up with obligers. That's by far the dominant pattern. So if you see a rebel and they're paired up either in romance or at work, like in a founding team, almost always it's with an obliger. It's not that there aren't exceptions, but they are exceptions. Usually it's an obliger. The hardest pairing is the upholder rebel. Whether it's in romance or it's a boss and an employee or it's a parent and a child, because they just see the world in such opposite ways, and they are kind of extreme personality types, and it's like the upholder wants to make a plan and execute, and the rebel wants to be spontaneous and leave things open, and they just kind of drive each other crazy. So that's hard to manage. But I think that's the toughest one.
So I have a question, and then I think maybe we'll take one more question after that and then kind of wrap up if that works for you. So the birth order thing actually triggered this in me, because I was thinking children's literature, lots of only children and lots of chosen ones, children characters, whether they're only children or not. So can you maybe talk a little bit about any tendencies that might relate to that sort of birth or related thing or personality related thing, and also kind of position of any favorite children's literature characters who are either only children or chosen children, or how those intersect?
I think it's like, you know, probably what you're talking about, I think, gets to the whole, the whole issue of like orphans and children and, exactly chosen ones, whether it's, you know, Harry Potter or, you know,
Katniss
Skywalker I'm sorry?
Katniss.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's, I guess it's that, you know, that I don't know, that fantasy of that sort of being special. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, I mean, it's a little bit different, but, I always had a fantasy when I was a kid that I had some secret, aunt or uncle that I didn't know about, that suddenly when I turned, 18, was going to bestow all this money and this sort of legacy, and then some kind of sense of it, then, exactly, that I was going to be sort of plucked out of the boring miasma of my actual family.
Who knows French? Isn't that like a French idiom, my American uncle? Isn't that like a French thing? Yeah. And that's exactly that.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, my American uncle.
Yeah. I think it turned out I had like a, and $100 savings bond from a great aunt. But it's funny, one thing that made me think of also is, famously to me, Ramona actually started as sort of an add-on because I interviewed Beverly Cleary on the occasion of her 90th birthday. She's still alive too, but I think she's 102 now, maybe 101. But she, her first book was Henry Huggins, and she had, and Jesus was one of Henry's friends in the neighborhood, and there's some other kids. And she said, I guess she realized, as she was finishing the book, that all the kids were only children in the book, as she herself had been. So she says, well, somebody should have a sibling. So she just kind of threw in Ramona at the last minute as this kind of sibling for Beezus, and, you know, a little bit of comic relief. And then, you know, she kept writing sort of Ramona grew. But yeah, I love it that, like, probably, you know, my favorite character in all of children's literature is probably Ramona. The fact that she just kind of started as a kind of a practical, you know, solution to a perceived problem is kind of one of those wonderful kind of, I don't know, serendipities of art making, I guess.
So one more question and then we'll call it night. Yeah, oh, Jen.
So picking up from your question, given that you write a lot, there's a lot of context in the writers are, we talk about the kinds of characters in children's literature, pressure people, most children's writers fall into a certain tendency.
I don't know. It's like I could see all tendencies coming to it in their own way. So I don't think that there would be one particular tendency that could do it. But I'd have to do a lot of research. That would be a fun thing to research. I don't know. Do you get a sense? Well, like Margaret Wise Brown is probably a rebel.
That's the one I was thinking. Yeah.
But I can think of
that. You know,
J.K. Rowling's probably an upholder.
Mm. I think that Beverly Cleary was probably, was a questioner. I mean, she actually started by kind of questioning she was a children's librarian. She was kind of questioning the books that were available for children. That's kind of what led her to
interesting
writing.
Ooh, this is like a whole new, like, side project.
Yeah.
Yes.
He
Yale Konigsberg is probably a questioner.
Yeah. I guess it would be hard to
How did you write about Yale Konigsberg? Did you?
Wait.
The Mix of Files?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I love every single one of her books.
Yeah.
Even the random ones that nobody talks about. You get a right volume, too.
Yeah.
William Steig? William Steig?
Well, I did have, somewhere in my introduction, I actually have like a cover my ass paragraph where I say, there's all these great writers that I didn't write about. So, yeah, some of these people were, Steig was definitely, Steig for sure was in there.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much, everyone.